With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Everyone here is mad.
Greetings. You are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Wow, what a week we've had. Okay, let's get tonight started off with some cool tunes.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, that you can count me out. Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright. You say you got a real solution. Plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all doing what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait.
The stories of Egypt and its uprising all over the news, there are certain aspects that you don't expect to hear about, and one of which was about the Egyptian museums, which is a high point of their society and a point of their personal and cultural pride. Human shields of civilians protected the museums When vandals and would-be thieves broke into the museums, there were no guards and no police during this tumultuous time. Egypt's ancient treasures appear to be safe today after citizens and later the military had banded together to stop the looters amid an uprising that left some of the world's most prized artifacts perilously vulnerable to common thieves. Egyptians, desperate to protect their country's heritage from the kind of mass looting that devastated Baghdad's museums in 2003, created this human shield around Cairo's Egyptian Museum this week, linking arms in front of the historic site and chasing down vandals who had managed to enter the building after it was abandoned by the country's police. Ahmed Ibrahim explained why he was standing guard. The museum, the 26-year-old told the Associated Press, has 5,000 years of our history. If they steal it, we'll never find it again. Another man begged crowds outside the museum not to loot its archaeological finds. We are not like Baghdad, the man shouted, according to the AP, and later the army arrived to help secure the site. Inside lay priceless treasures, from the golden mask of King Tutankhamun to the statues of pharaohs that are thousands of years old. Looters did inflict some damage, breaking a statue of King Tut, for example, and throwing it carelessly on the floor, but museum officials said they could repair the artifacts and noted that the destruction could have been far worse. I am so happy to announce that today everything is safe, says Antiquities Chief Zahi Hawass told the AP. If the museum is safe, Egypt is safe. Hawass said that looters bypassed the museum's priceless artifacts and stole jewelry from the gift shop instead. I'm glad these people were idiots, he told Time magazine. They looted the museum shop. Thank God they thought the museum shop was the museum. Still, images of shattered mummies and broken statues from inside the museum flooded the internet today, disturbing archaeologists and historians around the world. On his blog, Hawass said that he was grateful Egyptians had worked together to protect their heritage, but said the looting was a tragedy. My heart is broken and my blood is boiling, he wrote in a posting he sent by fax to colleagues in Italy so that it could be uploaded to the internet. Now remember, the internet was turned off for a short period of time in that country. I feel that everything I have done in the last 9 years has been destroyed in one day, but all the inspectors, young archaeologists, and administrators are calling me from sites and museums all over Egypt to tell me that they will give their life to protect our antiquities. Many young Egyptians are in the streets trying to stop the criminals. Due to the circumstances, this behavior is not surprising. Criminals and people without a conscience will rob their own country. If the lights went off in New York City or London, even if only for an hour, criminal behavior will occur. I am very proud that Egyptians want to stop these criminals to protect Egypt and its heritage. Elsewhere in the country, though, there were reports of looting by vandals. Hawass said on his blog that thieves stole nearly 300 artifacts from a museum storage site on the Sinai Peninsula, but he said most of the treasures had been returned. And though the military is standing guard at the pyramids of Giza, one American archaeological group based in Egypt said some of the artifacts inside the pyramids had been vandalized. I've heard that the team lost some equipment and that there was some damage to the antiquities, but I do not know the extent of that at this point, Jerry Scott, the director of American Research Center in Egypt, told the blog Unreported Heritage News today. But mostly, Egyptians seem determined to guard their country's heritage amid swelling protests that have brought chaos to the streets and threatened to end the 30-year rule of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Ismail Sarah Geldin, the director of the Bibliotheca Alexandrina, thanked Egypt's young people for protecting the library's historic collection. The library is safe thanks to Egypt's youth, whether they be in the staff of the library or representative of the demonstrators who are joining us in guarding the building for potential vandals and looters. Sarah Geldin wrote this on the library's website, and you can check that out. It's linked and it's up and running. And this just in from another desert location, an all-student crew lands at Mars Research Station. Yes, Mars. Huh? Are you kidding me? Is this a headline from the future? Students landing on Mars? Actually, it's happening now, although not quite on Mars, but as close as humans can currently get. 6 college students are the latest crew to embark on a 2-week stint at the Mars Desert Research Station. It's a simulated Mars habitat set up by the Mars Society, located in the San Rafael Swell of Utah. Looking across the very Mars-like red rocky panoramic vistas outside the habitat, participants might think that they are on the red planet. And this latest crew, the 99th for MDRS, will be testing a microbial detection system and an EVA optimization method using an iPad. Yes, technology is technology. The students, all graduate students or about to be, are from different colleges but came together in the summer of 2010 at the NASA Academy at the Ames Research Center in California, which is a 10-week immersive research internship. At the NASA Academy, we worked on a group project called LAMBDA, the Life and Microbial Detection Apparatus. Participant Max Fagan from Dartmouth University told Universe Today. We wanted to do some follow-up work in looking at microbial fuel cells, which run off the metabolic activity of bacteria. Technology that could be applied to sewage reclamation plants in order to generate power. Fagan said the technology has been around a while, but they are trying to adapt it to detect microbes in soil samples, similar to what the Viking mission did in the 1970s. We put a sample into the device, and based on the power that is generated, you can determine whether that power is coming from microbial activity or organic activity, Fagan said. They finished the summer internship with a good theoretical analysis and a non-working prototype, but they wanted to field test their research as well as continue work on other individual projects. Donna Viola, a senior undergraduate at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, had been on two crew rotations on the MDRS previously and suggested to her fellow NASA Academy team that they apply as a group to the MDRS where they could test LAMBDA in actual conditions with soil samples in the field where they may be potentially extremophile forms of life to find. The team was accepted and began their crew rotation at MDRS on January 29th. They will be there until February 12th, all the while in complete Mars simulation. Crew members must wear a spacesuit when going outside the habitat. They eat only space travel type food, along with vegetables grown on site in a greenhouse. Power is provided by batteries or a power generation system, and there's also a water recycling system. Viola is the commander, Heidi Beamer is the team geologist and executive commander, Kevin Newman is the engineer, Andy Gilkey is the team scientist and health and safety officer, chief biologist, Sukrit Ranjan is the team astronomer, and Fagan is the EVA engineer. You can see all the crew biographies at a link on universitytoday.com. The 14 students total were part of the NASA Ames Academy, and even though only six are at the MDRS, the rest are serving as ground and mission support. Now, the last 6 weeks of the team, they've been updating the LAMBDA device and making it field-worthy, integrating it with the control system, and testing it. So while at the MDRS, the crew has a few other projects, such as working on a proposed combination EVA planner and the EVA monitor that runs on an iPad. It monitors the astronauts' health, vital signs, and how much energy they're consuming, whether they should speed up or slow down. It's basically an EVA optimizer, Fagan said. Now, they will also fly a payload on a high-altitude balloon that tests the feasibility of using balloon-borne payloads on Mars. There are no FAA regulations on Mars, so on Mars you can build a weather station on a balloon, such as on a 10-kilometer tether, and reel it in and out and give very nice vertical cuts of the atmospheric profiles of wind velocity and direction and dust profiles, Fagan explained. And also, you could do astronomy by launching a small telescope. But we can't do the tether part because they're here on Earth, so we'll be using a balloon and have to retrieve it. They will also be flying a generic meteorological payload and or several of them, and doing astronomical projects at the observatory on site, the Musk Observatory, that's the observatory they're using, which has a 14-inch telescope. During their stay, the crew is required to send daily reports and dispatches from the commander, engineers, crew scientists, and journalists through the MDRS website, which provides updates on the status of science experiments, updates on crew health and morale, and on the habitat and how it is faring. There's also a live webcam of different parts of the station. MDRS is the second research station to be built by the Mars Society. The first was the Arctic Station, FMARS, which was on Devon Island built in 2000. Stations to be built in Europe, the European Mars Analog Research Station, EuroMars, and Australia, the Australia Mars Analog Research Station, Mars Oz, are currently in the planning stages. The goal of these analog research stations is to develop key knowledge, field tactics, and equipment needed to prepare for the human exploration of Mars, testing habitat design features and tools, and to assess crew selection protocols. Utah is much warmer than Mars, and the desert location is optimal because of its Mars-like terrain and appearance. Now, if you want to find out more about it, you can go to Mars Desert Research Station, their website at mdrs.marssociety.org. Now, on that site, the first dispatches from the Lambda crew report how they are getting acclimated to the habitat and the equipment, as well as preparing for doing their actual science research. Fagan said, without the NASA Academy at Ames, this group of students wouldn't be together at the MDRS today. This grew out of everything we did at the NASA Academy, he said. Without those experiences, we would have no idea how to approach the situation, wouldn't understand the science or engineering that needs to go into such a project, and certainly wouldn't have the team working abilities to do this if we hadn't developed them while we were at the NASA Academy. Now, you can learn more about this if you go on the NASA Ames Academy website, and that's linked from NASA, and Universe Today hopes to provide an update on the Lambda Crew's activity as well. And here's a little music break from Symphony of Science. This is where they take words spoken by famous scientists and they put them on a synthesizer so it sounds like they're singing. And it's pretty cool. It features Sagan, Dawkins, Kaku, and Jastro on this particular selection. Enjoy.
With every century, our eyes on the universe have been opened anew. We are witness to the very brink of time and space.
We must ask ourselves, we who are so proud of our accomplishments, what is our place in the cosmic perspective of life? The cosmic perspective of
the
life.
Exploration of the cosmos is a voyage of self-discovery.
As long as there have been humans, we have searched for our place in the cosmos.
Are there things about the universe that will be forever beyond our grasp? Are there things about the universe that are ungraspable?
One of the great revelations of space exploration is the image of the Earth, finite, lonely, bearing the entire human species through the oceans of space and time.
Matter flows from place to place and momentarily comes together to be you. Some people find that thought disturbing. I find the reality thrilling.
As the ancient mythmakers knew, we're children equally of the earth and the sky. In our tenure on this planet, we've accumulated dangerous evolutionary baggage. We've also acquired compassion for others, love for our children, and a great, soaring, passionate intelligence, the clear tools for our continued survival.
We must ask ourselves, we who are so proud of our accomplishments, what is our place in the cosmic perspective of life? Cosmic perspective.
We could be in the middle of an intergalactic conversation, and we wouldn't even know. Are there things about the universe that will be forever beyond our grasp? Are there things about the universe that are ungraspable?
One of the great revelations of space exploration is the image of the Earth, finite and lonely, bearing the entire human species through the oceans of space and time.
Matter flows from place to place and momentarily comes together to be you. Some people find that thought disturbing. I find the reality thrilling.
we've begun at last to wonder about our origins. Star stuff, contemplating the stars, tracing that long path. Our obligation to survive and flourish is food, not just for ourselves, but also to that cosmos, ancient and vast, from which we spring.
One of the great revelations of space exploration is the image of the Earth, planet and moon, bearing the entire human species through the oceans of space and time.
Matter flows from place to place and momentarily comes together to be you. Some people find that thought disturbing. I find the reality thrilling.
Think of how many stars, planets, and kinds of life there may be in this vast and awesome universe.
With every century, our eyes on the universe have been opened anew. We are witness to the very brink of time and space.
Hey, you ever wondered why you use your left hand versus your right hand, or some people are ambidextrous? Well, hand preference in humans and animals have sort of been explained here with this new research. Whether you are more frequently using your right hand or your left isn't so much a choice as it is hardwired in your brain. Now, some people have thought this for a very long time. Other people think it's a matter of choice. There's been an awful lot of research over the last 20 years with regard to this. And forcing a child at a very young age to go from one hand to the other, say they're left, and to force them into right hand, has been linked to all sorts of learning difficulties later on. So the gist, hand and limb preference in humans and other animals is tied to eye preference. Eye preference, in turn, is linked to which side of the individual's brain is more dominant. Cerebral lateralization, or how information processing is divided and coordinated between the brain's hemispheres, controls limb preferences. Now, when a southpaw shakes hands, his left eye and right portion of his brain are working hard to process the other individual, suggests a new study. The research helps to explain why hand and limb preferences exist across numerous species. The predisposition, as it turns out, are tied to ocular dominance, or the tendency to prefer visual input from one eye over the other. According to the study published in the latest Royal Society Biology Letters, that would be this month. Now, ocular dominance, in turn, is driven by cerebral lateralization, which refers to how information processing is divided and coordinated between the brain's left and right hemispheres. In recent U.S. history, the majority of presidents have been left-handed: Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, William Clinton, and Barack Obama. Bet you didn't know that. I know I didn't. But scientists haven't yet found a link between hand preference and an individual's abilities. Now, at this stage, we have no reason to think that left or right-brained animals are superior or analyze information differently, except that it's the mirror image, said co-author Cullen Brown, and that is what they told to Discovery News. Now, Brown is a director of advanced biology at Macquarie University, and colleague Maria Magat studied the phenomenon in Australian parrots. These birds, like humans, have a tendency to use either the right or left limb more than the other. The researchers recorded the eye and foot preferences of the parrot while the birds investigated small pieces of fruit and brightly colored wooden blocks. The majority of the birds showed a clear tendency to investigate the objects using either their left or right eye. The eye preference was found to directly correspond to the foot that each parrot used to manipulate the food or block. If one of the birds focused on the fruit with its right eye, for example, then it would tend to use the right foot to grasp and move around the food. This provides a better view in front of the preferred eye. Since the right hemisphere of the brain controls the left side of the body, the left hemisphere controls the body's right side, and the eye limb preference also reveal which side of the individual's brain dominates, at least during visual investigations anyway. Now, genetics combined with personal experience are likely to help control cerebral lateralization. Sulfur-crested cockatoos are all left-footed, and prior research on these birds found that they start off experimenting with both feet, but eventually settle on the left. That's interesting. Now, a similar course of action happens most likely in humans. As infants, we don't know that we are destined to prefer one hand over the other. Experience determines which hand works best, and it is the most comfortable to use, setting into place a more permanent practice. Although right-handedness is the norm for most people, with only 10% of humans being left-handed, the key to individual success appears to be how strongly the individual is lateralized, since other studies show that offer significant cognitive advantages. Now, if we use one hemisphere for analyzing some information and the other for analyzing different information, we effectively have two processes occurring simultaneously, which is a bit like having a computer with two processors. Moreover, practice makes perfect, Brown added, and the more you train on one task using one side of the body, brain, the more efficient you become. Leslie Rogers, an emeritus professor at the University of New England School of Science and Technology, agrees with the findings. She said she proposed a hypothesis in a 2009 paper extending the conclusions to amphibians and other tetrapods, including primates. It is pleasing to see that the research on birds supports this hypothesis, Rogers told Discovery News, and some mysteries do still remain about handedness. However, such as in why certain species all individuals show very similar hand or foot preferences, and in others, anything goes. So some species and individuals are not as lateralized much at all, now indicating that handedness has some sort of as yet undefined cost in addition to its advantages. More research is going to be done, and we will bring that to you here because I have it tagged. I have people who ask me about this all the time. Very popular subject. And in more biology news, skin cells switch to beating heart cells. A new approach borrows from stem cell methods to convert cells faster. What this is about is a direct reprogramming method which switches skin cells to heart cells. The new process is faster, taking just 5 to 6 days to make beating cells. The new heart could be grown from a patient's own skin and used as a transplant. Now, the skin cells could be converted directly into beating heart cells, a new study shows. Okay, that's what we're talking about. The transformation occurs with a little help from cellular reprogramming factors that are usually used to make embryonic-like stem cells. Scientists from the Scripps Research Institute and the University of California, San Diego reported online January 30th in Nature Cell Biology, so you can look that up. Instead of taking mouse skin cells all the way back to the stem cell state and then coaxing the cells to form heart tissue, the researchers switched the cells directly from skin to heart cells. The team briefly introduced the reprogramming factors and then gave the skin cells a bath in chemicals that induce heart development. Other researchers have converted skin cells directly into nerve cells, and previous studies have worked out ways to grow heart cells from embryonic-like stem cells, but the new process is faster. It only took 5 to 6 days to make beating cells with the new protocol, whereas it would take weeks to convert skin cells to an embryonic-like state, and then more time to develop those cells into heart cells. Direct reprogramming may be used to grow new hearts for transplant from a patient's own skin or to help repair damage after heart attacks. Now, scientists also want to use such cells to learn how some genetic defects affect development of the heart and other organs. Now, again, if you want to check that out, it's in the Nature Cell Biology, dated January 30, 2010. Do you remember hearing about the recently reported aerial photographs of the uncontacted tribe that was in the Amazonian rainforest? Well, Brazil has allowed the release of rare photographs of an uncontacted Amazonian tribe to bring attention to the plight of indigenous people whose rights groups are faced with possible annihilation. Now, these astonishing images showing curious adults and children peering skyward with their faces dyed reddish-orange and toting bows, arrows, and spears were taken by Brazil's National Indian Foundation, FUNAI. Rights Group Survival International, which accompanied the government agency on the overflight near the Brazil-Peru border, said that their baskets were full of papaya and manioc grown in a communal garden. Illegal loggers will destroy this indigenous people. It is essential that the Peruvian government stop them before it's too late, warned Survival's director, Stephen Corey. FUNAI has released similar photographs in the past and acknowledged that Peruvian loggers are sending some indigenous people fleeing across the border to less affected rainforests in Brazil. Now, in 2008, indigenous tribes expert Jose Carlos Marais released a set of photographs that allegedly documented an uncontacted tribe. Those images were later determined to be staged in an elaborate hoax that he claimed was intended to raise awareness of logging. Now, the coordinator of Brazil's Amazon Indian organization, COIAB, Marcus Apurina, says that he hopes that these images would draw attention to the plight of the indigenous peoples and encourage their protection. It is necessary to reaffirm that these peoples exist, so we support the use of images that prove these facts. These peoples have had their most fundamental rights, particularly their right to life, ignored. It is therefore crucial that we protect them, he said. FUNAI says that there are 67 tribes in Brazil that do not have sustained contact with the outside world. Some are often referred to as uncontacted tribes, quote-unquote, even though they are, some of them kind of have some, albeit limited, contacts. Now, a year ago, Rights Group sent a letter to then-President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, voicing concern that the very survival of indigenous groups was under threat. Brazil's latest census counted more than 500,000 indigenous people among more than 190 million Brazilians. Millions in the country, however, have some indigenous ancestry. Most indigenous people in the Americas descend from Asian people who crossed a land bridge from Siberia an estimated 13,000 to 17,000 years ago. One notable exception, the indigenous people on Chile's Easter Island in the Pacific are ethnic Rapa Nui Polynesians. Now, if you want to know more about this, you can check it out on discovery.com. They have some really cool photos and a really nice slideshow. So, let's bring a little bit more attention to stop the logging in the Amazonian forest. We need that forest, and these people need to retain their homeland and their indigenous, status. We don't really need to contact them. They have been living just fine all these years there. Why do we need to go and disrupt them and annihilate their culture? Now, here's a story, and this could be confirmed by any primatologist that you talk to and anyone who's spent any length of time with primates, other than human primates, of course. It's a mother's grief, the startling images which show how chimpanzees mourn their dead just like humans. Now, chimpanzees appear to mourn their dead infants just like humans do, scientists have discovered. Well, they're just reporting it. I think scientists discovered this before, it just wasn't listened to by the powers to be. Chimpanzee mothers establish close physical relationships with their young, carrying them for up to 2 years and nursing them until they are six. But now scientists have filmed how one chimpanzee mother, whose 16-month-old infant died, apparently begins the grieving process. It's the latest evidence highlighting just how similar chimps and other great apes are to humans. Now, the ape continued to carry the body for more than 24 hours before tenderly laying it on the ground. Then, from a short distance, she watched over her child. Periodically, she returns to the body and touches the face and neck with her fingers to establish it was dead. She then took the body to other chimpanzees in the troop to get a second opinion. The following day, the chimp had abandoned the body, according to a report by scientists from the respected Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics. Now, the scientists said that the research provided unique insights into how chimpanzees, one of humans' closest primate relatives, learn about death. Dr. Catherine Cronin and Edwin Van Leeuwen, together with Professor Mark Bodemer of Gonzaga University in Washington State and Innocent Malenga, videoed the chimpanzee in Zambia, which is, native habitat for the chimps, And Dr. Cronin said, after carrying the infant's dead body for more than a day, the mother laid the body out on the ground in a clearing and repeatedly approached the body and held her fingers against the infant's face and neck for multiple seconds. She remained near the body for nearly an hour, then carried it over to a group of chimpanzees and watched them investigate the body. The next day, the mother was no longer carrying the body of the infant. The report, published in the American Journal of Primatology, said almost nothing is known about how primates react to the death of close individuals, what they understand about death, and whether they mourn. The researchers therefore believe that they have reported a unique transitional period as the mother learned about the death of her infant, a process never before reported in detail like this. The videos are extremely valuable because they force one to stop and think about what might be happening in the minds of other primates, Dr. Cronin said. Whether a viewer ultimately decides that the chimpanzee is mourning or simply curious about the corpse is not nearly as important as people taking a moment to consider the possibilities. Previous reports have documented chimpanzee mothers carrying their deceased young for days or weeks, showing the strength of the mother-infant bond. The latest research complements these observations and sheds new light on how chimpanzees might learn about death. Professor Bottomer said, these data contribute to a small but growing body of data on how non-human primates respond to death. We hope these objective accounts will continue to accumulate and eventually allow researchers to take a comprehensive look at the extent to which non-human primates understand death and how they respond to it. It was only a matter of time and at the right conditions that chimpanzees' response to death could be recorded and subjected to analysis that would reveal remarkable similarities to human. Chimps are humans' closest relatives in the wild. Like people, they can use tools, using sticks to fish out termites, hunt in teams, and plan ahead. They are also one of the few animals that can recognize themselves in a mirror and realize that they are looking at a reflection. Now, if you want to see this this video, you can find it on YouTube. You can go to that Daily Mail and basically just Google video of chimp mourning dead infant, and it'll pop right up.
At the ground I stand upon, I'm searching for fragile bones. I'm never gonna be refined. Keep trying, but I won't assimilate. Should we have come far in time?
Watching the rage.
And speaking of evolution, we have a frog species that has suddenly evolved extra teeth. The Gastrotheca guentheri, or better known as Gunther's marsupial frog, which I did a whole bunch of research on, is the strangest frog in the world. 200 million years ago, it had a full mouth of teeth. The lower teeth evolved away, then suddenly reappeared thousands of years later. It's the best evidence yet of re-evolution. As far as frogs go, Gastrotheca guentheri is an oddball's oddball. The entire Gastrotheca genus comprises of the so-called marsupial frogs, so named because they carry their eggs with them in pouches on their back. But the guentheri species is even more unusual because it's the only known frog species with teeth on its lower as well as its upper jaw. What's even weirder is that this frog species originally had these teeth, then lost them, then re-evolved them after 200 million years. It's some of the best evidence yet for the still fiercely debated question of whether species can re-evolve complex features that they once possessed but then lost. Dr. John Wines explains how he made this startling finding and what it means. I combined data from fossils and DNA sequences with the new statistical methods and showed that frogs lost their teeth on the lower jaw more than 230 million years ago, but then they reappeared in G. guentheri within the past 20 million years. The loss of mandibular teeth in the ancestor of modern frogs and their reappearance in the G. guentheri provides very strong evidence for the controversial idea that complex anatomical traits that are evolutionarily lost can re-evolve even after being absent for hundreds of millions of years. Wines proposes this represents a loophole, quote-unquote, to the currently understood process of evolution. The frog species lost its bottom teeth, yes, but the underlying mechanisms that would allow them to regrow teeth remained intact through those hundreds of millions of years. Wines explains why that makes a difference. What G. guentheri did was to put teeth back on the lower jaw rather than having to re-evolve all the mechanisms for making the teeth, quote-unquote, from scratch. This loophole may apply to other cases when traits appear to re-evolve, such as in the re-evolution of lost fingers and toes in lizards. Re-evolution still isn't a particularly well-established concept, hence the rather unimaginative name, but a lot of evidence is now piling up to support its existence. Beyond these strange frogs, scientists have discovered re-evolved wings on stick insects, renewed coiling in limpet shells, and as we talked about before, the lost and found digits in lizards and dinosaurs. Does this mean that we're going to end up redeveloping our tail? Who knows? Don't climb any trees. He might be encouraging a trait that we really don't want to have again. We're going to have to get all new kinds of pants. Oh, and here's something very exciting. A new African wolf has been discovered. Scientists studying genetic evidence have discovered a new species of wolf living in Africa. The researchers have proven that the mysterious animal known as the Egyptian jackal and is often confused with the golden jackal, but is not a subspecies of jackal, but a gray wolf instead. The discovery by a team from Oxford University's Wildlife Conservation Research Unit, WildCRU, and the University of Oslo and Addis Ababa University shows that gray wolves reached Africa around 3 million years ago before the spreading throughout the Northern Hemisphere. The new wolf is a relative of the Holarctic gray wolf, the Indian wolf, and the Himalayan wolf. The report of the research is appearing this week in the journal PLOS-1, or PLOS-1. I call for short. Professor David MacDonald, the author of the paper and director of Oxford University's WildCRU, said, "A wolf in Africa is not only important conservation news, but raises fascinating biological questions about how the new African wolf evolved and lived alongside not only the real golden jackals, but also the vanishingly rare Ethiopian wolf, which is a very different species with which the new discovery should not be confused." Now, Professor Claudio Solero, also of the WildCRU and chair of the IUCN's Canid Specialist Group, who has worked in Ethiopia for more than two decades, said, "This discovery contributes to our understanding of the biogeography of the A-fauna, which is an assemblage of the species with African and Eurasian ancestry, and which evolved in the relative isolation of the highlands of the Horn of Africa. Rare Ethiopian wolves are themselves a recent immigrant to Africa and split off from the gray wolf complex even earlier than the newly discovered African wolf. Dr. Eli Runes of the University of Oslo is the first author of the paper, and he said, "We could hardly believe our own eyes when we found wolf DNA that did not match anything in GenBank." Professor Nils Stenseth, the author of the paper and the chair of the Center for Ecological and Evolutionary Synthesis, or CES, said, "This study shows the strengths of modern genetic techniques. Old puzzles may be solved." The team also found genetically very similar specimens to this new wolf in the highlands of Ethiopia, 2,500 kilometers from Egypt, suggesting that the new species is not just found in Egypt. Professor Afwerk Berkeley at Addis Ababa University added, "This shows how genetic techniques may expose hidden biodiversity in a relatively unexplored country like Ethiopia. Golden jackals are regarded by the International Union for Conservation of Nature as not threatened, a species of least concern, quote-unquote, but the newly discovered African wolf may be much rarer. The team believe it's a priority for both conservation and science to discover its whereabouts and numbers." Professor Solero said, "It seems as if the Egyptian jackal is urgently set for a name change, and its unique status as the only member of the gray wolf complex in Africa suggests that it should be renamed the African wolf. More on this as it develops, and I will bring it to you." I'm totally excited about this. That's so cool. Conservation noted. And along these same lines, was the fox prehistoric man's best friend? This is very interesting on phys.org.com. Early humans may have preferred the fox to the dog as an animal companion, new archaeological findings may suggest. Researchers analyzing remains at a prehistoric burial ground in Jordan have uncovered a grave in which a fox was buried with a human before part of it was then transferred to an adjacent grave. The University of Cambridge-led team believes that the unprecedented case points to some sort of emotional attachment between human and fox. Their paper, published today, suggests that the fox may have been kept as a pet and was being buried to accompany its master or mistress to the afterlife. If so, it marks the first known burial of its kind and suggests that long before we began to hunt foxes using dogs, our ancestors were keeping them as pets and doing so earlier than their canine relatives. The cemetery in northern Jordan is about 16,500 years old, which makes the grave about 4,000 years older than the earliest known human dog burial and 7,000 years earlier than anything similar here involving a fox. Writing in the open access journal PLOS1 or PLOS1, the researchers also suggest that this early example of human-animal burial may be part of a bigger picture of growing cultural sophistication that was typically associated with the farming societies of the Neolithic era thousands of years later. Sadly for fox lovers, however, the relationship between man and that particular beast was probably short-lived. The paper also says that it is unlikely that foxes were ever domesticated in full, and that despite their early head start, their recruitment as a friendly household pet fell by the wayside in later millennia as their human masters took to the more companionable dog instead. The burial site provides intriguing evidence of a relationship between humans and foxes which predates any comparable example of animal domestication, said Lisa Mayer of the Leverhulme Center for Human Evolutionary Studies, University of Cambridge. Now, also said, "We appear to have, what we have appeared to have found is a case where a fox was killed and buried with its owner. Later, the grave was reopened for some reason and the human's body was moved. But because the link between fox and human had been significant, the fox was moved as well, so that the person or people would still be accompanied by it in the afterlife," which is what we had reported before. Now, the research focused on the contents of the two particular graves in Jordan, which is situated on an ancient river terrace in the small river valley of Wadi Ziklab. And the site has been one of the major interests for archaeologists since the first graves were opened in 2005, because it provides a rich source of information about the so-called Epipaleolithic period 16,500 years ago. The Cambridge-led team spotted a connection between Grave 1 on the site and Grave 8, which lies beside it, but was only opened more recently. In the first, they identified the remains of two adults, probably a man and a woman. The man had been buried earlier than the woman. Alongside him were the skull and humerus of a fox, as well as other grave goods. It was only when Grave 8 was opened, however, that the researchers found both human remains may have belonged to the same man, and that the skeletal remains of what was most certainly the same fox. The fox skeleton was complete apart from its skull and right humerus, which is exactly what they had already found in the adjacent grave. Further studies indicate that the remains were indeed those of a red fox. The movement of the body parts is believed to be highly significant. If the human body was the same in both cases, then none of the other grave goods except the fox were considered worth moving, strongly suggesting that the fox had some sort of special relationship with that particular human. Other such cases are very rare. Many of the earliest involved dogs, including one site in Israel where a woman was buried with her hand resting on a puppy, and even they are about 4,000 years younger than the ones in Jordan. Now, the very first evidence of a dog domestication in the Near East involves a burial of a puppy with a human. Dr. J. Stock, also from the Leverhulme Center at the University of Cambridge, said, "It's easy to imagine that the similarly sized fox, who was also viewed by the prehistoric people as a potential companion in the same way, clearly it had significant social status. Studies carried out on foxes suggest that they can be brought under human control, but that the process is not easy because they are skittish and timid by nature. Perhaps for that reason, the researchers suggest dogs ultimately achieved best friend status among humans instead." This story was provided by the University of Cambridge, and you can look up that report on PLOS1. Well, that about does it for this episode of Savage Science. I hope you have a wonderful week. Keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails. Until next we meet again, on the way out, going to play you a little bit more Symphony of Science. We are all connected.
We're all connected to each other biologically, to the earth chemically, to the rest of the universe atomically.
I think nature's imagination is so much greater than man's. He's never gonna let us relax, relax.
We live in an in-between universe where things change all right, but according to patterns, rules, or as we call them, laws of nature.
I'm this guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star. The planet is just another speck. To think about all of this, to think about the vast emptiness of space. There's billions and billions of stars, billions and billions of specks.
The beauty of a living thing is not the atoms that go into it, but the way those atoms are put together. The cosmos is also within us.
We're made of spark stuff. We are a wave
of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
We're all connected to each other biologically, to the earth chemically, to the rest of the universe atomic.
I find it elevating and exhilarating to discover that we live in a universe which permits the evolution of molecular machines as intricate and subtle as we.
I know that the molecules in my body are traceable to
phenomenon in the cosmos that makes me want to grab people in the street and say, have you heard this?
The beauty of a living thing is not the atoms that go into it, but the way those atoms are put together. The cosmos is also within us. We're made of stark stuff. We are away from the cosmos and know itself.
There's this tremendous mass of waves all over in space, which is the light bouncing around the moon, going from one thing to the other, and it's all really there, really, really there. But you gotta stop and think about it, about the complexity, and really get the pleasure. It's all really there, really, really there. The inconceivable nature of nature. To think about all of this, to think about the vast emptiness of space.
There's billions and billions of stars, billions and billions of specks.
The beauty of a living thing is not the atoms that go into it, but the way those atoms are put together. The cosmos is also within us.
We're made of stark stuff.
We are away from the cosmos and know it's all.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned